Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to say, as I begin, before beginning, the words in our reading, we forgive ourselves and each other, and we begin again in love. If I had to say what would be a core truth to take away from today would be that. To forgive ourselves and to begin again in love. For many of us know, and we'll in a minute talk more about comfort zones, many of us know that to forgive ourselves is a trial. Much less to love ourselves so that we can begin again in love. These are not easy things. We have recently been talking about spirituality and worldviews, and how our spirituality is related to worldviews. And we have traveled from 50,000 BCE up to the present time, trying to understand a worldview, an external worldview, that we may be able to interpret who we are in this moment, in this time, to give us directions on how to act and the decisions we make and how we build communities and how we participate in our communities. And today I am suggesting that just as we have built an understanding of a worldview, for example, how that might work. We have a worldview, and we're looking at, from last week, it seemed to begin in abundance, at least in 33 countries. There were food riots in 33 countries, in countries of poverty. And we might ask, why? I mean, we know there's been poverty, but why all of a sudden are there food riots? We really haven't heard that before. And a worldview might say that 150 years ago, that Western civilization began to base itself on oil, and we've had the empire of oil, and that oil has been the glue that holds us together and which we stand on and how we move our lives, and from growing our food to driving to church to our buildings. And if you think about, if we had no oil, what would our culture look like? I mean, we would indeed collapse, and we would be out of Iraq, one says. Yes, well, depending, but some of us believe that. Are we now seeing food riots because the empire of oil is retreating? Because it's getting more expensive to process. There are some saying that in 50, 30 years, there will be no more oil. And that as any empire retreats, and if you study history, and any empire that retreats, you know that as it pulls in, generally there's chaos and a struggle for power around the fringes. And we've done some study in the history of the nation of Israel, and indeed that is how the nation of Israel came to be in 800 BCE and 1000 BCE, was that Assyria and some other empires withdrew because they were having internal troubles, and when they do that, other nations had a chance to come up and claim power as people organize themselves. So are we seeing the beginning of the collapse of the oil empire manifested itself in these food riots? Well, that would be an interpretation from a particular worldview. I'm saying yes, and I'm also, as I suggested last week, said that does affect our spirituality. If we feel and if we have empathy for other human beings that struggle in this world for food, we indeed will be affected. It will affect us. Today I'm suggesting that just as we have some understanding and we've studied to understand a worldview to find our place in time, to help us make decisions about who we are and our values, and give us direction, we also must understand who we are internally. We must understand what it is about us that creates a vision or has an ideal self about this world, and at the same time our behavior is not congruent with accomplishing that vision or accomplishing what we need to do to bring about that ideal self. What is it about us that we actually stop ourselves from achieving the best that we can be? Why do we stop ourselves from achieving and potentializing our gifts? And I'm going to call that the comfort zone. And when I first mentioned the comfort zone, Helen got excited thinking, oh, that's a positive thing. You're going to talk about a comfort zone that we can get in and relate to each other and find our comfort zone. You're going to talk about how people ought not be intrusive to one another and how we ought to be mindful of one another and respectful of one another so we can create a comfort zone in which to live so that ultimately we can be a closer community, we can be more intimate, we can be more mindful of one another. And when she said that, I thought, yeah, that's exactly what I meant, but it wasn't exactly what I meant. What I was talking about, the comfort zone in which the boundaries of our comfort zone are actually prison walls. So we have both. A comfort zone in which we need to operate out of so that we can feel safe enough to engage one another and voice our opinions and be close in relationship and close in community. But also, we find ourselves in a comfort zone that stops us from being the best that we can be. That stops us from potentializing. Our church also has a comfort zone that may stop it from potentializing what it can be in this community. If you remember the story of Buddha coming to enlightenment that we have studied before, and that he was a child of a king and was being reared to be king. And he realized that in being king, he could not really bring about the changes in people that he needed to because of the pressures that are on the king, the military pressures, the economic pressures. He realized that he could not do what he wanted to do, so he knew that he had to take a spiritual path. He was uncomfortable with where he was, and he was seeking his positive comfort zone. And he went and he found his first teacher, and his first teacher taught him how to breathe. His first teacher taught him how to let go of the past and the future and find his place in the here and now. And then his first teacher said, I can see that you are a great man and you learn quickly, and I am old and I'm going to die soon, and I would like for you to take over teaching my students. And the Buddha said, no, I am not going to do that. There's still something in me that hasn't conquered this fear of death. There's still something in me. There's still something uncomfortable in me that drove him inward. He still had that inner anxiety. He still had that. He could not stop in a very comfortable place, being a teacher of a community, because of that inner anxiety. He would not stop. And so then he went on. And he found another teacher. And this other teacher taught him about the illusion of reality and about how we create our own reality in our minds, and that Buddha worked with that and tried to understand that and he came to understand that. And this teacher offered him the same thing. This teacher said, I am old and going to die and I need somebody to take my place, and you are a great learner and you would be a great teacher, and would you take my place? And the Buddha said, no. I will not take your place, which would have been a very comfortable life. My guess is it would be like professor at a university or something, tenure, pension, health care, whatever it might be, it would have been comfortable. But he said, no, I cannot do that because there's still something inside me churning that I have not yet resolved. It's, I'm not reconciled within myself. I'm still divided within myself. So he went on. And he began his meditative process. And just before he moves into enlightenment, as he's meditating and exploring his inner world, he says this, I see you, jailkeeper. I see you, jailkeeper. I see the one that is in my mind that keeps me in prison. And I've seen you all these years, you have kept me in prison. And I see that, and I see you. And I'm going to move past you to become who I need to be spiritually. And I thought, here's the Buddha, after years and years of exploring spiritually, finally coming to the point, he says, where I see you, jailkeeper. Now, in my work as a counselor, if we can get to the point where we can breathe deeply while we're anxious, I'm happy. If I can get to the point where I'm no longer emotionally reactive to events that remind me of my past, or I'm no longer emotionally reactive to somebody that brings a different view up, or I'm no longer emotionally reactive when I hear somebody talking on the TV about politics, you know, I've done something, which means I've let go of my past. And if I'm not anxious about my future, that means I've let go of my future, and I can stand in the present and breathe deeply, letting go of the past and future. I'm really happy. That was his first phase. Then to recognize the meaninglessness, in a way, of the paradigms and worldviews that we receive in this life and accept in this life that are really illusions and not reality and really hold me prisoner, to recognize that is really something else again. The Buddha, after all of that, there's still this jailkeeper binding the Buddha. And what I'm suggesting today, whatever that jailkeeper was in the Buddha's mind, in the Buddha's imagination, that is the core of the prison walls that keeps us in our comfort zone. Now, I had planned to have props here, so you're going to have to imagine with me. And my props are me getting anxious and pulling out a bag of potato chips. My props are me getting anxious and reaching for an alcoholic beverage. My props are me getting anxious and picking a fight with my partner. My props are those things when I'm anxious that I do to attend to my anxiety, because I can't work through my anxiety, so I have to bind my anxiety, which keeps me in the prison of my comfort zone. Those things that we do that stop us from expressing our truest voice. An example of how that happens from childhood on. Let's say that I grow up in a house where every time I share what I want, I'm second born, so I have an older brother, younger sister. We have a lot of uncles and aunts around when I grew up, and cousins, and there's a lot of activity. Shaming humor, I don't know if you're familiar with shaming humor, was a big deal in our house, especially if we could pick on somebody else and everybody laugh at somebody else because I wasn't the one being picked on. Right? So we did that, shaming humor, right? So let's say that every time in my home, when I expressed what I really wanted, it was used against me. Somebody would take it, somebody would hide it, somebody would break it. I mean, anything. Somebody would use it. Somebody would say, well, if you don't cut the grass, you can't have that. You know, or those kind of bargains. And there's no way I wanted to cut the grass, right? Because an acre of grass. But if I want that, those kind of bargains. But whatever, my favorite thing, you know, they tell you when bringing up a child or in a relationship, you never threaten the most positive hope and the most positive dream of the child or the person you're with. Not the most positive. Because you end up killing the hope. So you don't do that. But if you're brought up in a home where that is the norm, well, when that child becomes an adult, that child will be in a relationship where the other person will say to them, why don't you ever tell me what you want? I can't read your mind. How many of us fall into those kind of traps? You know, I do. What do you want? You know, why don't you tell me? I don't even know what I want. That's a comfort zone, because if I express what I want, I would have to go through all the pain and anxiety that I experienced from childhood to adulthood. I'd have to deal with all those people in my head that I have memories of that used something against me, that shamed me, that said, you want to join the band instead of playing football? What's wrong with you? You see some negative word. You're crying? What's wrong with you? All those things that are normal human activities get shamed. Then I build a wall around me, which I will not go through that wall, which I will not break through that comfort zone, which means I will not be my best self, which means I'm not really available for intimacy and relationship, which means my best self is not really available for me in communities, because I'll sit back and withhold my own self. Our church has recently created a vision statement. And it's a good vision statement. And we're in some of our minds, not collectively, some collectively, some individually, we're working on a mission statement. Here's the problem with the comfort zone. The problem with the comfort zone is I stand behind and live behind the barrier of that comfort zone, and I know when I'm there, and all of us may know when we're there, when we're grabbing the chips, when we're doing the things we know are harmful, but we discover ourselves doing them anyway. That's how you know you're supporting your comfort zone. Whatever that might be. That's how you know. So I stand behind that barrier, and I look at life beyond that barrier, and my vision of life, my vision of this church, my vision of myself, my vision of what relationships could be, my vision of how I might interact with my children to help them along in their life, that vision is on the other side of that comfort zone boundary. I would have to, for my ideal self, for my best self, to participate in the community the way I really want to participate in the community, that's on the other side of the comfort zone boundary. So we got our vision statement. We're still working on our mission statement, because the mission statement means I'm going to have to take the steps to bring me through the comfort zone to do things I wouldn't normally do to accomplish the vision. The mission statement is the actual behavior of accomplishing the vision. And if I create the mission statement, I get closer to confronting myself, am I going to work through my comfort zone? I've been to some UU churches where if you bring up words such as church, Jesus, God, any Baptist, Bible, you bring up those words, and we have an emotional reaction to those words, because many of us come from Christian backgrounds or religious backgrounds that were abusive toward us. And we don't want nothing to do with it. I know that I'm hiding behind the barrier of my comfort zone when I'm emotionally reactive. That's another clue. And how many of us come into a church and say, I'm going to be here and this is going to be a good place for me, but I'm never going to invest myself the way I once did? How many of us ever been hurt in a relationship? And in your mind, and you look at your behavior, and somewhere you negotiate with yourself, my heart will never be that vulnerable again, because that pain was just too much. I'm never going to be involved in a community again like I was involved in a community, like I was there. It took years of my life because I felt betrayed. And there are betrayals. I had a very good friend who was going to this church, and he was in the choir for 16 years. Hey, when you get in a choir, what I see that happens in a choir, you get to know each other. You get to talk to each other. You're not here just on Sunday morning. For 16 years, he went through a divorce, and usually when there's a divorce, one person will leave the church, one person will stay, or they'll try to struggle. But he left. Nobody ever called. From his primary church community, nobody ever called. So the betrayals do happen. And he was one of those people that said, I'll never sing in the choir again. I'll never do that again. And we do that. When we do that, we solidify that comfort barrier. The best that could be in our lives is on the other side of that comfort barrier, but we have to take risks in order for that to occur. I'd like to share two stories and ask this question. What is it that can move us past that comfort zone boundary that is generally steeped in pain and hurt, and we've made a decision we're never going to cross it again at any time in our lives? What would make us want to do that, and what would need to happen for us to do that as Unitarian Universalists? And I was reading this book recently, and it's called The Third Testament. And this guy is saying, from a Christian tradition, you got the Old Testament, you got the New Testament. So he wrote this book called The Third Testament. And in the Third Testament, he tells the stories of people's lives. St. Augustine, Tolstoy, John Donne, And there's another one, but the one I want to talk about today is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I don't know how many of you know the name Dietrich Bonhoeffer. But he was a Lutheran pastor in Germany in the 20s and the 30s. And very committed to his church and very committed to his understanding of who Jesus Christ was. Just very loyal and very committed. And soon as Hitler was elected to office, he began protesting against the will of many of other pastors. But he saw what was happening in Germany. And he said, how could a Christian person tolerate abuse and tyranny of others and be unwelcoming of all people? How could that be? So this is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He had three opportunities in his life to leave Germany. Now, we know that people left Germany during the 1930s. Paul Tillich, a theologian, left, comes to mind. Sigmund Freud went to England. And we know that significant people were escaping Germany. In 1933, this fellow Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he was in England working in a parish, and they said, don't go back. And he says, no, I have to go back. My people are there. My church is there. I have to go back and serve. I have to go back. You know, that's my calling. Whatever was going on inside of him, whatever touched his heart, whatever moved his heart religiously, moved him in his mind not to abandon the parish he was called to serve. So in 1933, he went back. And he was involved in the underground and those kind of things. Then, in 1939, he went to visit America. Now, that culture is more intense. And they said, don't go back. And he said, I will have no right to be part of the reconstruction of Christianity in Germany unless I go through the trials and tribulations that other Germans go through as we go through these difficulties. Did not go back. He joined a group of people that plotted to assassinate Hitler in the 40s. And they wanted to assassinate Hitler. They wanted to install another government that would move toward peace. And I'm thinking, I'm liking this guy. this man who was a pacifist got to the point where saying, this is too much. And then he was arrested. And in 1944, as he was in prison, his fiancée's family and prison guards were making a way for him to escape. And he said, no, I can't leave because my uncle and brother, who are also in prison, would suffer if I left. What moves a person to clearly go beyond any comfort zone they have, knowing their life is in jeopardy for the sake of others? How does that happen? How does a passion dwell and get into their hearts that their vision of what is good in life pulls them through all trials and tribulations to the point of their own death? His fiancée, and the day they were engaged, in 1942, he was arrested. And she followed him from camp to camp to camp. And she was a young woman, 18 or 20. And later, after the war, she was asked, Maria von Wedgemeyer, she was asked, well, what was that like for you to have that experience of your fiancé, this man, in the concentration camp? And I got a picture, and I don't know how to communicate this. So I'll try, though. Have you ever been in just a huge parking lot, a stadium parking lot, just huge, by yourself, and you notice the vastness of it? And that you were alone. So hold that image in your mind. Here's a picture of Felsenburgh concentration camp. And here's the guardhouse. And then there's just this big empty lot in this guardhouse. Right? And she had
news that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was there.
So she's asked the question after the war, what was this like for you? And she says, I was getting closer and closer to a man whom I was not really getting closer to. I went first to Flossenbürg. You could take a train to something like 7 kilometers from the camp. I walked to the camp with a sack full of clothing for Bonhoeffer. I knocked on the door and said, I have been told by the Gestapo in Berlin that Bonhoeffer had been transferred to this concentration camp, that I had brought clothing, and would they please deliver the clothing to him and return the old so that I could take care of them and wash them.
Now, from all my knowledge of concentration camps, I'm staying away. I'm running. I'm not going there. Out of tremendous fear, but that is my imagination. Here's this young woman, 7 kilometers, and then she's got to walk through the parking lot. And she goes up and knocks on the door with a satchel of clothes, saying, could you please get them to Dietrich Bonhoeffer and bring me his old clothes? You've seen movies and pictures of concentration camp, the old clothes torn up, horror. And here's this young woman. What moves her past her comfort zone? She was from a fairly wealthy family, horses, land. But she's knocking on the door of a concentration camp with an attitude of service to somebody she loves. What moves her? What would move us as Unitarian Universalists? What would move our hearts to have such a vision that nothing dysfunctional, nothing hurtful from our history would prevent us from accomplishing the vision we set before us? What fire, what passion, what softness, what love would need to happen in our hearts that no matter what happens, I'd be willing to walk up to the concentration camp and knock on the door? I'd be willing to be in a prison and saying, no, even though there's a path for me to escape, I'm not going to escape because it would cause more difficulty for these people. To be in another country and saying, no, I'm not going to stay, I'm going back into hell because that's where I'm called and that's where I'm needed. What needs to happen within us that we would understand that and we could become that, that when we set a vision for who we are as individuals in the church, nothing from our history, nothing from our neighbors, nothing from our fellow congregants would prevent us from showing up and doing what we need to do to accomplish the vision. How do we get past the comfort zone? These two people got past those prison walls because of their love for one another and their love for their religion. That's how they did it. We can also do it by recognizing our frailties. And when we cross that boundary, or we self-sabotage crossing that boundary, we forgive ourselves and we begin again in love. That's how we do it. We forgive ourselves and we begin again in love.